Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking about Syria and its role in the politics of the Middle East. The Bush administration policy toward Syria was one of isolation, but the Obama administration is taking a different approach in the hope that engagement with Syria might do a couple of things, one being blunting the influence in the Middle East of Iran, and the other to get Syria and Israel talking again. We'll try to talk about these and perhaps some other recent developments in the Arab world this morning as we talk with Joshua Landis. He is the co-director of the Center for Middle East Studies. He's also assistant professor of Middle Eastern Studies at University of Oklahoma. He's also a member of the School of International and Area Studies. He teaches modern Middle Eastern history and politics. He also writes on Syria and its surrounding countries. He writes the Syria Comment. That's a daily newsletter on Syrian politics that attracts some 3,000 readers every day. It is widely read by people in Washington, in Europe, and also in Syria. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome. The number, if you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call for you, you can use our toll-free line, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. So once again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point, questions, comments are welcome from listeners. The only thing that we ask of people is they try to keep their comments and questions brief so we can keep moving along. But anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Professor Landis, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, I think maybe we might start by talking a little bit about Syria and the United States. And I wonder if you could do a little comparison and contrast here for us. Talk a little bit about the Bush administration and its Syria policy, and now the Obama administration. And it certainly seems that now we're seeing a significant change.
Yes, we're seeing this is night and day, or well, let me not exaggerate night and day, but it's a big change. And under Bush, you know, as we recall, President Bush had big plans for the Middle East when he went into Iraq in 2003, and he thought he was going to change the greater Middle East. He called it reform of the greater Middle East. And Syria was on his list of countries to change. It was going to be Iraq first, but after that, there was Iran and Syria. And so he didn't. The Bush administration did not want to engage with Syria in any way because it would make it harder to change the country. And they restricted the ambassador here, Imad Mustafa, in Washington. The Syrian ambassador was not allowed to speak with any government employees of significance. And in Syria, it was the same thing. The Americans withdrew their ambassador. There was no dialogue, really, a very minimal dialogue between Syria and the United States. And including with that, Bush administration, by pursuing a UN investigation of the Hariri murder in Lebanon, tried to squeeze Syria diplomatically through isolation. Syria just went to Austria. President Assad just went to Austria for the first time in 4 years that he went to Europe, traveled in Europe, because he was not welcome there. And so there was diplomatic isolation. There had been several layers of economic sanctions placed on. There were UN decisions taken to try to squeeze Syria, and an investigation into their supposed authorship of murder of a prominent Lebanese prime minister, Rafik Hariri, in February 2005. And so Syria has been playing rope-a-dope for the last 4 years, and now Obama comes out and looks like they're willing to engage Syria in some meaningful way, both trying to push Israel forward to discuss peace. There's a major, one of the major conflicts, and certainly the thing that puts Syria at cross purpose with the United States is that Israel, in 1967 war, took a big hunk of Syrian land, the Golan Heights, which is strategically important, economically important. And that has been at play since then about whether Israel's going to give it back, under what conditions, so forth. And Syria wants to get it back. And this is why Syria supports groups like Hamas, Hezbollah in Lebanon, groups that America terms as terrorist groups, and sanctions Syria because of this. Syria supports them, claiming that this is occupied land and that they are supporting liberation groups. And they're using it as a leverage against Israel to try to get Israel to give back their land. So as long as that land is not given back, we're sort of locked into conflict in the region. So Obama is looking into attempts to solve that question. And the Bush administration tried to solve that question by breaking the back of the Arab regimes, in a sense of breaking the back of the Syrian regime. Now Obama, it's unclear how Obama will go about that, but it's through dialogue and through compromise, and that's the big. So the Syrians are very eager about this. The Israelis are a bit leery, and they're not sure if it's if they're going to be the ones that have to compromise. So that's where we are right now. And there's elections coming up in Lebanon, which is going to be meaningful. And of course, there's elections coming up in Iran this summer, which are going to be meaningful.
Yeah. As you say, the administration now has sent two fairly high-level State Department people to have talks. I think there has been two.
Yes.
Two meetings between these folks from the United States and the government of Syria.
Right.
So it's clear that there is this the beginning of this process of engagement. I guess one of the things, though, that struck me is that as far as the United States is concerned, it's still listing Syria on its list of nations that sponsor terrorism, along with Iran. So that suggests that, well, maybe we're not exactly sure, or is it that, in fact, that we still have to maintain, at the same time that we're talking, we also have to maintain this image that says, well, we're still concerned about terrorism, and we're not going to let them slide on this particular matter.
Well, it's a complex issue. It's like Hamas. Here is the major Palestinian group that won elections in 2006 that controls Gaza, where there's just been a major conflict, and America wants dialogue between Israel and the Palestinians. At the same time, they proscribe Hamas as a terrorist group, and they won't talk to it. So it's very difficult. We've been locked in this sort of no-talking situation for some time, and it's difficult to promote compromise and dialogue when one side is proscribed as terrorist. And, you know, I guess you can use that as leverage to try to get them to make certain concessions, like, say, we recognize Israel within these borders, we won't use violence anymore, etc. But it's very difficult to enhance peace, to promote a dialogue under these conditions, and that's why. But at the same time, we've got a long tradition of doing this. We are allies with Israel. We are following Israel's lead on this. And so there's only so much wiggle room. And Hezbollah in Lebanon is a non-state militia. Hamas is the same thing. And this, you know, this creates a lot of ambiguity. Now, what Obama's trying to do is to not completely close their eyes to these groups, but to try to deal with them at the same time, saying you're not going to emerge from this status as terrorists until you make some major compromises. On the other hand, we want to deal with you. And that leaves an ambiguous relationship. And a lot of people don't like it. But on the other hand, I think most statesmen believe that's the necessary way to go. That's what happened, for example, in Northern Ireland. We didn't prescribe the Irish groups as terrorists and not talk to them at all. We talked to them, and we brought them in, and that's where we got a dialogue, and today Ireland is moving ahead happily.
The guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Joshua Landis. He's an assistant professor of Middle Eastern Studies at University of Oklahoma, where he's also co-director of the Center for Middle East Studies. We're talking about Syria. Questions welcome. In fact, we have someone ready to go. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. First caller here is on line number one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to get back to your earlier comment about Golan Heights, and you're starting to say, well, Israel took it in 67, and therefore Syria has since then been supporting Hamas and Hezbollah, et cetera, et cetera. But you sort of stopped at 67. You didn't mention the earlier points during which Syria had used the Golan Heights to regularly shell Israel, and that therefore this was a strategic land that was being taken in part to prevent further, well, say, aggression towards Israel, if you whether you want to call it aggression or not.
Right.
You could deal with that, but you have to recognize that that's the reason, and the fact that Israel, whatever you want to say, returned the Sinai, which also took in 67 to Egypt, and was able to work out a peace agreement, and yet wasn't able to, for whatever reasons, and I think it's important to there's reasons on the Syrian side that are quite significant that made it impossible to work out a so-called peace agreement between them, between Israel and Syria,
right.
And the fact that Syria has a long history of taking a more extreme position against Israel, whether it's in supporting Hamas rather than the PLO, et cetera, et cetera. So I'd like you to talk about that, and I'll get off and let you respond.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call.
You know, this is the who started it question of, you know, is Israel at fault because they started it, or is Syria at fault because they started shelling from the Golan Heights? You know, if we do a little history here, Israel's created in 48. There was a war over this. The Arabs did not want what they believed was Palestinian land and Palestinian majority population to be displaced. And Israel had just gone through the Holocaust, and they wanted a homeland and to be to have a place where they could be protected. Now, the Golan Heights, Syrian land, the border was left in question between Syria and Israel at the end of the 48 war. And when the UN took responsibility for trying to mediate this conflict, and they proclaimed the area around Lake Tiberias and the Jordan River, the swamp area north of that, as a no man's land, and only farmers, local farmers, were allowed to go into this land and change the geography. Now Israel wanted to develop, and they needed the water. Most of Israel's water comes from this northern Lake Jordan. I mean, Lake Tiberias in the Jordan Valley. So Israel began to go and change the geography up there by putting in a big water carrier that was going to take water, takes water down to Tel Aviv and feeds Tel Aviv and then goes down to the Sinai and makes the desert bloom. Now, all this meant that Israel was defining its border with Syria in a way favorable to Israel. Syria began to lob cannon fire, say, you can't do this. This is violates the UN, no demilitarized zone. And Israel pushed up there because they wanted the water and they didn't want to be subject to Syrian dictates. And Syria bombed them. Then Syria tried to build some dams on tributaries of water from the Golan that would go down into this Lake Jordan area. And Israel bombed those, saying, no, you can't build dams. And this is the situation. Now, you can accuse Israel of breaking this no-fly zone. You can say that Syria shouldn't have responded with military action. At any rate, The fact of the matter is that Israel is much more powerful than Syria. Every time they've come to a conflict, Israel has smashed Syria, and it's taken more and more land in order to defend itself and to settle settlers on. They kicked over 100,000 Golanis out of the Golan, and now there are about 300,000 Golani refugees in Syria who want their land back. And this is a national sore for Syria. Syria will not relent on the Golan Heights anytime soon. And the longer it's not settled, the more conflict there's going to be. And Syria has a big incentive to support radical groups. So that's the way I would answer this. I mean, I don't want to get into a blame game, but the fact of the matter is that there are outstanding issues of who owns what since the creation of Israel. And those need to be settled. And until they're settled, there's going to be ongoing conflict. And you know, as for the question, the caller said, is Syria worse than other Arab countries? You know, is it more radical somehow inherently? I don't think it is. Egypt was always believed to be the worst. Nasser was called the Hitler on the Nile or the Mussolini on the Nile, and they were the worst Arab, you know, proponents of Arab nationalism. But then once the deal was struck and the land was exchanged, land for peace, Egypt has become one of the greatest defenders of Israel. And the same thing can happen with Syria, as has happened with Jordan. You know, here are the two major states, Jordan and Egypt, have become very good allies of Israel. And Syria can become a peaceful neighbor and a proponent of stability in the region if it comes to some happy conclusion on this go on.
But then, there's, as you say, though, this is a very difficult problem. We have to balance the concerns of both countries, both in terms of security, territorial integrity, and who gets to exploit what is an extremely important resource. I suppose that's what diplomacy is all about, but the question is, how does one go about trying to resolve all these difficult questions in a way that's going to be satisfactory to both parties?
Well, we got very close to this in 2000. Under Clinton, there were long negotiations that began with Rabin and ended up with Barak, Prime Minister Barak of Israel. And the Syrians agreed to a number of things. One is that there would be a sense of peace park in most of the Golan in which there would be no Syrian troops. There would be a 15-year withdrawal of Israel. There would be early warning posts that Israel would keep on high areas. There would be all sorts of things that, you know, Syria couldn't touch the water, et cetera, et cetera. There, the major dispute that remained between the two countries was whether Syria would get a strip of land about 100 to 200 meters wide along the edge of Lake Tiberias and so forth, or whether Syria be kept away from the water. And so it wasn't a big hunk of land, and that's where people tripped up, and Syria insisted on land all the way to those 1967 borders and to the edge of the water. Israel didn't want to do that. At least that's what we're left understanding as the difference. And, you know, a lot of people would argue that politically one side or the other couldn't make the deal, and so they backed out. But it's a solvable problem. Hmm. There are 25,000 Israeli settlers on the Golan that would have to be moved. That's a big problem. There was a water issue, there's the defense issue, but those issues, the water and the defense, have been more or less resolved. It remains a big political issue to back away. And the question that most Israelis ask is why? You know, ultimately, Syria is a very weak country. They try to annoy us with Hezbollah and Hamas, but we can take care of Hezbollah and Hamas. Look at, we just bombed Hezbollah in 2006 very badly in Lebanon, and they haven't made a peep since then. We just smashed Hamas in Gaza a little while ago, and they're just, you know, shreds of what they were previously. This is a police action. We can smash these things, and we can keep the Golan too as security. Now, Netanyahu is insisting that to give Golan back to Syria would be to invite Iran to be living on our border because Syria is an Iranian ally. And so he paints a very dire picture of what would happen if we gave it back and that security would be completely undermined. I don't believe that's the case. I think Syria would move away from its radicalism pretty swiftly if it could solve this problem. But, there are no guarantees.
The the last time that there was a change of government in Syria was in 2000 when Hafez al-Assad died, and he had been in power for 30 years, and his son, Bashar, became the president, and this was not the way things were supposed to go. He was not the person that was supposed to be the heir. There was an older brother. He, however, was killed in a car accident in 1994, so then the presidency passed to Bashar, who was never supposed to be the guy to take on that job. And I think at the time there were a lot of questions raised about how he would do as the president. Now, he's been in office 9 years, and he was reaffirmed back in 2007, although at the time I think he was the only guy on the ballot.
Yeah.
having said all that, I just wonder what you might say in the way of assessment of his performance as president.
Well, everybody wrote him off in the beginning. And at first, they were willing. He had about a year of honeymoon in which people looked at him as a young guy who had new ideas and so forth. And both, I think, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United States were looking to bring him away from you know, away from radicalism as America would be, away from anti-Israelism and anti-Americanism, and bring him into a pro-Western fold. On the other hand, they weren't willing to pay for very much with this. I mean, the Golan deals under Clinton fell apart, and so the same issues that have dogged Syria were still on the table, and this meant that Bashar al-Assad essentially continued the policies of his father. Bush came in with a very radical agenda after 9/11 and decided to invade Iraq, and that pit Syria against the United States. And he not only wanted to invade Iraq, but he wanted to overthrow this totalitarian, what he called totalitarian authoritarianism throughout the Middle East, and to overturn all the governments of the Middle East. You know, so there was enmity from the beginning. Now, Assad has done extraordinarily well. He had the Bush administration for a number of years trying to undermine him, and the Bush administration failed to do this. Syria today is in a fairly secure position, and it has the United States courting it, and it has most of Europe courting it. So, you know, in that sense, we have to give Bashar al-Assad fairly high marks in terms of his ability to turn around what looked like a very negative situation. And there isn't much opposition within Syria to speak of today. That's in large part because one pays a very high price to be opposition. But there isn't an underground violent opposition in Syria either. And most Syrians take the view that most Syrians are pretty apolitical and apathetic. They complain about the government a lot. They complain about corruption. They would like to have more freedoms. On the other hand, they do not want to be Iraq. You know, the Iraq experiment, we were told, was going to prove that democracy was the best way to govern the Middle East, and it was going to cause a domino theory to go, domino effect. Just the opposite happened. It proved out to be pretty disastrous. There are over 1 million Iraqi refugees in Syria today, and they're in a bad situation, and no Syrian wants to be like them. So no Syrian, very few Syrians are pushing for any kind of foreign aggressive involvement in Syrian affairs. And so when America got tough and gets tough, Syrians tend to back their own president. So that's the, in a sense, Bashar al-Assad's legitimacy within Syria as an authoritarian, as a in a sense, a quasi-monarch, if you will, he's gained legitimacy because people want stability. And that's what the Assad government has been able to provide people. And when he ran his, you know, sort of referendum in 2007, the big slogans were security, amen, wal istiqrar, stability and security. And he was running against the Iraq war and what was happening in Iraq. And you know, this was not a real vote, but by and large, people bought into that idea. And it's refurbished this notion that stability is very valuable.
Mm-hmm. We're at our midpoint of this first hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Joshua Landis. He is Assistant Professor of Middle Eastern Studies at University of Oklahoma. He is also co-director of the Center for Middle East Studies there and is a member of the School of International and Area Studies. He teaches modern Middle Eastern history and politics. He writes on Syria and the surrounding countries. He writes Syria Comment. That's a daily newsletter on Syrian politics that attracts some 3,000 readers every day. It's widely read by people in Washington, in Europe, and also in Syria. He regularly travels to Washington and consults with the State Department, other government agencies, and talks frequently on TV and radio about the Middle East. Questions here, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Something else that I'm interested in having you talk about, and I recognize this is a little complicated, but it has to do with this triangle involving the United States, Syria, and Lebanon. And I'm particularly interested in how it is in Lebanon continuing anger over the assassination of Rafiq Hariri. This was in 2005, in which Syria was implicated. At least a lot of people thought Syria was. I'm sure a lot of people in Lebanon thought Syria was behind this. Maybe some other people thought Syria was behind it too, which is still I think, as far as the people in Lebanon are concerned, this is an open sore. They're coming up to elections where the administration is just kind of getting started, forming a new policy in the Middle East, trying to have a new policy as far as Syria is concerned. How does Lebanon play into this?
Well, that's a that's a million-dollar question. Traditionally, Lebanon fell into a civil war in 1975, in which the major – it's a very fragmented society. They've got several major religious groups, Maronite Christians who are looked to Rome in the north, Shiite Muslims in the south, and Sunnis in the cities, and Druze, a offshoot of Shiism in the southern mountains. Now, these four sects have been at each other's, you know, they cooperate off and on, but they also dispute, and they fell apart into civil war in 75. And Syria stepped in 76 with the blessing of Israel and America in order to save the Christians who were about to get lose power and were getting beaten up by Muslim militias. Syria stayed, and Syria turned Lebanon into a sphere of influence and, in a sense, a dependency. Now, George Bush, and that had been recognized by American presidents. In 1990, George Bush, the father, when he wanted to create a coalition to help him fight Saddam Hussein and to retake Kuwait in 1990, he made a deal with Hafez al-Assad at the time, and he said, you help us in the Gulf, join our coalition, and we'll give you Lebanon. And it was that simple. Syria cleaned out last militias in Lebanon and consolidated its hold over Lebanon. America always referred to Syria in Lebanon as the Syrian president's presence in Lebanon, not Syrian occupation or anything else. That situation prevailed until 2003, when George Bush, the son, wanted to invade Kuwait and Iraq, and change the Middle East. And he wanted one of the things he wanted to do was to take Lebanon away from Syria, and so he began to talk about the Syrian occupation of Lebanon and so forth. And he tried to push Syria out. Now, Syria did not want this to happen. They did not want this important country along its underbelly to become an American dependency with a peace agreement with Israel and possibly American bases that would be used as a spearhead to destabilize Syria in this growing conflict with George Bush. So Syria hung on, and they stuck their fingers in, and they used all their allies. And Rafik Hariri, who was the major Sunni statesman who had been able to unify Lebanon in the 1990s, was killed. Now, it was very natural for people, Lebanese, to turn and blame Syria because it looked like his life, you know, that he was a victim of this tug of war. And an attempt to turn him to America's favor against his old ally, Syria. There's still an investigation going on, and just last week, four top security chiefs of Lebanon who had been kept in jail for the last 4 years during this investigation were released by the UN because there was no evidence to convict them, and they'd been held illegally in a sense for 4 years without any, you know, without any court trial or so forth. So that, at least the court case against Syria, looks like it's been very weakened, and there's possibility that there are other authors to this murder, and the people on the ground, there are Islamists who are being accused of this, and whether they have connections to Syria or not, we still don't know. But you're right. Many Lebanese still believe, you know, Lebanon is very divided, but the pro-American side, what we call the February 14th coalition, that's the day that Hariri was murdered and they demonstrated against Syria. This February 14th coalition still believes that Syria is, you know, is getting away scot-free. And Lebanon is very divided. But there are many Lebanese who side with Syria. And you know, I suppose, why do they do that? They do that for a number of reasons. They do that, first of all, because they're Shiite. The Shiites side with Syria, but also half the Christians do under General Owen, because the Christians are divided, and you take one side or the other. And so there is a coalition, what is probably half the population of Lebanon, that is pro-Syrian and is allied with Iran, against the other half, which is pro-American. And we're going to have elections in June 7th. And it's very possible that the pro-Syrian and Iranians will actually nose out the others. We don't know yet. It's going to be very close.
And how, and does that outcome, how is that outcome connected, or is that outcome connected to the interest of the United States, apparently, in trying to improve possibly even, and I came across an article, I think, recently quoting Jimmy Carter, who actually said that we would normalize, we would reestablish diplomatic relations with Syria. And he's thinking that's something that's going to happen
right.
sooner rather than later. I mean, how does the outcome in Lebanon, is that tied
to... Yes. Well, you know, that's a big question, because Clinton, Secretary of State Clinton, has said that if the pro-Syrian coalition wins, America will have to reevaluate their military aid and other aid to Lebanon. Sort of, you know, the question is, how much will they pull the rug out from underneath Lebanon if democratic elections go against America? Will they punish the Lebanese? Now, my sense is that Obama will not do, you know, he'll have to stop military aid and a few little things, but he won't want to punish. What he'll want to do is make a deal. Punishing doesn't seem to work. That's what we've tried to do in Iran, as we've tried to do with the Palestinians, and it's only made the situation worse. Why not make a deal? You know, you can't, these are, after all, fairly democratic elections. And so what he wants to do is get the best outcome in Lebanon. And that means that you'd have a coalition government and you'd have the pro-American forces well represented in a coalition government, which would mean that Lebanon would sort of limp forward with a very undecisive government that would represent all sides. And that's, I think, you know, both Syria has said that that's what they are happy to have, no matter which side wins. And that's where the deal is pointing to, that rather than try to force a winner, one side or the other, and to end this sort of terrible struggle between East and West, Syria and the United States, and to come up with some kind of compromise, which would leave, you know, Lebanon moving forward without it being at war, but with a seriously hampered, you know, without any clarity. And that's, you know, that's the alternative to Bush, who wanted clarity and got war.
All right, let's talk with some of the callers. Champagne is first in line, line one. Hello.
Hi. Let me just say, I am just a person who wants peace and justice, and I know those are vague terms in the Middle East, because I do believe it's in the strategic interests of the United States. I was impressed with your first response to the first caller who started talking about Syria lobbying rockets or whatever, and justifying the colonialization of the Golan Heights. And I heard that same refrain about the Hamas lobbying rockets and justifying that disproportionate use of force recently in Gaza. I agree with you wholeheartedly. We need to sit down, all the affected parties, including the United States, and apply common sense into resolving these foreign policy conundrums as opposed to recrimination and retaliation. And yet, George Bush seems to have been the antithesis to that. And my question to you, and you may not be able to look at it as a crystal ball, is there going to be any prospect of dealing with all the issues that exist in the Middle East, especially the Palestinian-Israeli issue? Because even King Abdullah of Jordan, whom I believe is a very moderate, sophisticated man, says nothing is going to happen in terms of improving Arab Muslim United States relations unless we can deal with the Palestinian-Israeli problem. So I just want to give you those questions and see if you can address those, sir.
Yes. Well, the Arab-Israeli, the Palestinian problem is right now the United States is trying to figure out, and Israel are trying to figure out, how they're going to move forward with this peacemaking. And traditionally, you get to this, you know, which track are we going to go first on, the Syrian track and try to resolve the Golan issue, or the Palestinian track? Now, Netanyahu has just come out, the Prime Minister of Israel has just come out and said, we want to do the Palestinian track first and not do the Syrian track. Others, Martin Indyk and other statesmen, U.S. statesmen, who have suggested that it'd be easier to do the Golan issue because it's much simpler to solve. And first, On the other hand, there's going to be dickering over where do we go first. And all sides here distrust each other. The Arabs believe that Israel is, you know, wants process and no peace. They just want to draw this out as they continue to increase the size of settlements and so forth. Israel believes that the Arabs, Israel equally distrusts the Arabs. And as Netanyahu has said, he said, you know, we cannot have a Palestinian state on our borders. We cannot have Syria come up on the Golan. These are enemy states, and they're dying to kill us. They want to push us into the sea, and we're locked in this big struggle with them, and we've got to win. So, and now here comes Washington wading into the middle of this and trying to, in a sense, force a compromise. And now in the past, under Bush, he said, we're not going to force anything. We're going to let these two sides talk. The Obama policy has been, if America doesn't take an active role, these two sides are not going to resolve their problems. And so this means arm twisting. Now, the Palestinian issue, I think you're right. It's very hard to resolve our conflicts with the Arabs and to buy any good faith from Arabs, so long as America looks like it's holding Israel's hand as it colonizes the West Bank, as it expands in the West Bank, and there is no resolve because El Arabiya, Al Jazeera, all the Arab stations are constantly showing every day. They're showing this conflict in the West Bank, and it tears at the hearts of Arabs to watch families be evicted from their homes and this constant warfare, in which Israel does much better than the Arabs, and the Arabs get beaten. So how do you change that? Today, it's very difficult to change it, and a lot of people are beginning to give up hope that a two-state solution can be resolved, can be arrived at, in part because since the 67 war, since the West Bank was captured by Israel, there are now almost 500,000 Israeli settlers on land that was captured in 67, whether that's in East Jerusalem or in the West Bank. Now, many Israelis say, but we can still separate this because the land that has been colonized is right around Jerusalem. It's a fairly small area, and if the Arabs are willing to sacrifice a certain amount of that land to keep, let's say, 80% of the settlers within Israel, we can still do a deal. It's not finished, and that's Obama's. You know, Obama's attitude is we have to go for a two-state solution because if we don't, we're going to end up with an occupation that goes on forever and this constant conflict. And then every time America tries to organize Arabs with Israel against Iran to balance Iran or to any other common goal, there's going to be unwillingness of Arabs to work with America or with Israel. And we're going to be against a constant, you know, banging our heads against a constant stone wall. And so that's the challenge for Obama, is to disentangle this West Bank problem, which has become very entangled and is very difficult to disentangle.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I'd like to introduce once again our guest, Joshua Landis. He is Assistant Professor of Middle Eastern Studies at University of Oklahoma, where he also co-directs the Center for Middle East Studies. He teaches Middle Eastern history and politics and writes a lot about Syria and its surrounding countries. And questions welcome, 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Next caller here where we are, Champaign County. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Good morning. I don't know. I have a couple of points I'd like to ask you to comment on. And the first one is I don't know that you've mentioned the accusation about this nuclear facility that Israel bombed in Syria. And I don't know the truth of the situation. I'm skeptical of assertions by Israeli and U.S. intelligence. There's a long history of fixing the information. So, but it does strike me that Syria could have been building something, or they could have been building something that would have been appropriate eventually for a facility to sort of provoke the situation, which is they're being asked to have inspectors come in, according to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, while their neighbor isn't even a signatory and has very sophisticated nuclear weapons. So it seems to me that whatever the truth of the matter is, that asymmetry is rarely commented on the U.S. press except in passing. so I'd like to hear what you would have to say about it. And then there was a reference to negotiations, and I've been trying to sort out what happened in the lead-up to Gaza, because the Turkish mediated talks were about ready to negotiate direct negotiations between Syria and Israel, and that was scuttled by the attack on Gaza. Now, we know the U.S. was opposing those talks. Elliot Abrams' office particularly was virulent about no outreach to Syria by anyone. So it seems to me that there was a factional battle going on both in Washington and Tel Aviv, and I wanted to know what you know of those circumstances.
Right. Well, this is a complicated question, but if we boil it down, it comes to balance of power. And Israel is extraordinarily powerful in the Middle East and has been able to defeat any Arab comer and any coalition of Arab comers, and expand territory, capturing territory, and then in order to offer it for land for peace, or at least in theory offer it for land for peace, since 1967. Now, the Arabs, of course, in order to get land back and to turn the tables, have tried to increase their firepower and to gain equality with Israel. Now, Israel has a very developed and powerful nuclear infrastructure. And yes, it's not a signatory, and America has protected this. What is, you know, an odd situation in that Israel is not a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty Organization through the UN. Now, Syria is. In September 2007, Israel bombed a military plant on the Euphrates River in Syria that it claimed was either preparing to become or was a nuclear reactor. We don't know whether it was or wasn't. But it makes perfect sense for Syria to try whatever it can to increase its military power in order to get favorable negotiations with Israel over the Golan Heights. Now, America helped with the intelligence, we believe, and in this bombing, in the same way that America has designated pro-Syrian militias as terrorist organizations and proscribed them. The United States helped stop a ship going from Iran with arms going to Syria recently, and made it in Cyprus, and it was stopped. So, from a Syrian point of view, this looks like America helping Israel to remain the most powerful guy in the block. And that is, after all, America's foreign policy. Obama said in no uncertain terms in his election campaign that our most important foreign policy objective in the Middle East is Syria's, is Israel's, to help preserve Israel's military supremacy. That is America's foreign policy. Now, the Arabs, or at least the Arabs that are still at war with Israel, don't like that. They want to get more power in order to get better negotiating position. And they're frustrated in that aim. Now, is that hypocritical? Yes. In terms of international law, that's completely hypocritical. America's sided with one side, and it claims at the same time to be an even-handed broker. It's not an even-handed broker. And in a sense, the Arabs have got to come to terms with that, and that's what America is telling the Arabs. You know, you have to make a deal based on the balance of power, not based on international law. And the balance of power is weighed in favor of Israel. And so, you know, if you don't like it, lump it. And that's been, unfortunately for the Arabs, they have not lumped it. At least Syria hasn't, and a number of groups haven't, and they're still trying to even the balance of power and to get their land back in a deal that's favorable to them. And so, you know, Obama's coming in, and he said, well, we're not going to be so one-sided with Israel. And Israel's very anxious about that, and they're wondering, well, what does that exactly mean? How not one-sided are you going to be? The Arabs are encouraging Obama and saying you have to go back to international law and, you know, 67 borders and all this stuff. And it's not clear where Obama's going to go with all of this. And that's a big question.
It does beg the question of where you think he should go. I mean, you're being sort of the dispassionate observer. Don't you advocate international law?
I do. On the other hand, international law, you know, in a perfect world, you would advocate, and you would make Israel go back to 67 borders and give up East Jerusalem, and that would mean moving 500,000 Israelis out of the West Bank. But that's not going to happen. I think we know that's not going to happen.
Well, I'm sorry to, I don't know if you want an interrogatory here, but the courts do allow for adjustments, just not a Bantustan. I mean, we haven't heard Obama say contiguity as they coached Bush to say that he wanted a state that was contiguous that would, actually not be a Bantustanization. I don't know. There's only a few minutes left, and I would like you to treat the idea of what happened to the negotiations, the direct negotiations between Syria and Israel.
In 2000, I mean.
The ones that blew apart, you know, when Gaza was blown apart.
Right. In a sense, there were, you know, Syria wants to get the Golan to the 1967 borders, which is the most favorable borders for Syria. Israel doesn't want to do that. And Netanyahu has said they don't want to give anything back, really, on the Golan Heights. That they want Syria to fulfill a bunch of demands before they begin talking, which is to break relations with Iran, to give up support for Hamas, Hezbollah, and essentially to give up all their bargaining chips. And it's a way of scuttling talks to insist on these prerequisites, because Syria will have no bargaining power if it did these things. But, you know, Olmert kept these negotiations going on through Turkey. We're still not quite sure why. And at the same time, he then launched this war against Gaza. Now, whether that was because elections were coming up, whether, you know, he was pressured to do that by other people in his coalition, whether he believed that he could get better negotiating position with Syria by undoing Hamas. All those things are still vague. On the other hand, it's not promising because, in a sense, Obama, as well as Bush, did not criticize Israel for the Gaza campaign, in which Hamas was largely, it was not destroyed, but it was definitely degraded. And therefore, there was a further loss of bargaining and power on the part of the Palestinians and the Arab coalition at large, the Syria, so forth. Now, Obama said that he understood Israel's position and that he would have done the same thing in Gaza, or he didn't quite say that, but he approved of Israel's hitting Gaza very hard. And this, of course, caused the breaking off of relations, and it caused Syria to lose. It caused the whole Arab coalition to increasingly lose bargaining power. Now, that's what's going to happen in the future to a certain extent. And the Arabs don't have a good bargaining position. So if they're going to cling to international law, I'm just trying to be a realist here. If they cling to international law, now the Arabs claim that if they cling to international law, that in 200 years, they use the metaphor of crusades, that Israel is like the crusaders. They'll come, they'll spend 200 years here, they'll beat us up as long as America's number one and supports them. But eventually, we have the long breath, we can hold our breaths, and eventually we'll push them right out in 200 years. Now, if you take that analysis, then the Arabs are, hanging on. But I think perhaps more realistically is that Israel will continue to win and that the Palestinians will be put through the meat grinder if there isn't a settlement, and that the longer there isn't a settlement, the Palestinians will lose more and more land, their lives will be destroyed, and they'll become permanent refugees, and there will be no Palestinian state. And that's the potential downside of not agreeing to something that's less than international law.
Just, we have a couple of minutes left. Just for a second to return to the Israeli strike on the alleged nuclear facility in Syria. As you said, the United States, the CIA, said that they believed that they had evidence that that's what this was.
Yes.
The government of Syria said, no, that's not what this is. The International Atomic Energy Agency did some investigation, and they said, well, we don't know for sure, but we think that it actually would be worth a closer look. And the government of Syria said no. Which I suppose you would think that if the government of Syria was really interested in being cleared on this, they would let the investigators come in and collect whatever kind of samples that they would want to try to get a better assessment. And I suppose some people would say, well, the fact that the Syrians won't let the IAEA do that is tantamount to an admission that it is, in fact, what the Israel said it was and what the United States said it was.
You could take that line of analysis. You could also say it's a matter of national sovereignty. And Syria, you know, has just witnessed Iraq go down that road. Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction. America insisted it did, and bad things happened. Now, you see, if Syria, I mean, from a Syrian point of view, if you look at it from Damascus' point of view, here is this facility that got bombed. I don't know what it was, and we don't know. Let me just put it, we can't say for sure. But yes, in theory, if Syria let the UN go and investigate, and the UN wants to look at four or five different, you know, three or four different sites around Syria to make sure that there's nothing in any site. Now, what if they find advanced missile technology? What if they find something that's not nuclear, but that is also, but that they don't like? Now, this will give there'll be more questions raised, and people like John Bolton and others who were at the time in government in the United States will then have a whole bunch of new intelligence to begin saying, well, what about this? What about that? We have to look at this, and making accusations that Syria is bad because it's trying to increase its military power. And so that leads you into a trap if you're a country where you've got these investigators. I mean, America doesn't allow for this kind of stuff on its – most countries don't allow for it, this kind of intrusion and inspection. Now, if you believe that the UN was just doing its job, you might go with that strategy. If you believe that the UN is politicized and America's using it to try to undermine Syria's military position, then from a Syrian point of view, you would say, don't let them in. If you open this can of worms, they're going to be crawling all around, and they're always going to have questions, and they're going to want more and more intelligence. And that's the Syrian, you know, Syria, maybe they're paranoid, but that is the Syrian point of view. And so you could read this in a different way.
Well, we are going to have to stop there because we're here at the end of the time. We want to thank our guest, Joshua Landis. He's assistant professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He co-directs the Center for Middle East Studies. He writes a daily newsletter, Syria Comment, on Syrian politics. And he teaches modern Middle Eastern history and politics there at Oklahoma. Professor Landis, thanks very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, David.